Last time we were on Daf Lamed Chesam and Aleph, and we were up to, I think, the Gufa, two lines before the lines get wide on Daf Lamed Chesam and Aleph. It's the last word on the line. So the Gemara had quoted in the previous section, in the previous part of the Sugya, the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Gufa Amar Rav Chana Bar Ami Amar Rav Pidas Amar Rabbi Yochanan Hay Oved Kochavim Bicharich Resha. Let's say the guy has the head of an animal and he sort of singes it in order to remove the hair. And in the process, he apparently rendered parts of it at least edible, particularly the ear is mentioned, the tip of the ear, which is very soft, so it cooks very quickly. So there's enough when he's mecharich the resha, when he singes the head, that part becomes edible. So Rabbi Yochanan had said. Obviously, a Jew did shechita. So the Jew is allowed to eat from it, and we don't say that it's a problem of bishalakum, that the non-Jew cooked it because his intent wasn't to cook. That's what the Gemara said. Right? He had no intent whatsoever. So now, Amar Ravina, Hilkach, therefore, Hai Ove Kochavim, Dishada Sichta La'atuna. Supposing there's a guy who throws a Sichta, is a peg or something like that of clay, and he wants to bake it or dry it in the oven. So his purpose is to do what? Is to complete a clay, to do a Gemara Malach on a clay. The cover by Yisrael Kara Meikara. And a Jew had buried in that oven, before the non-Jew fires the oven up, he had buried a gourd. He had buried a gourd in the ashes in the oven, and now the guy fires up the oven. He doesn't see the gourd. And he's firing up in order to bake this yateid. So Ravina says that it's permissible to eat it. Now obviously the Gemara says it's a situation where the kavar by Yisrael kara meikara. The Jew had placed the gourd in the oven before the guy put the stuff in. If the Jew places this thing in the oven after the guy fires the oven, of course it's not a problem, Bishop Lachem. If a guy lights a fire and then a Jew puts a pot on it, puts food on it, that's not even a question. Aaron?
Can't we assume that this is an oven that was used for people making their upper desserts?
Why?
Why would you assume
this guy just did that? What, he just decided one day he was going to do that? Or that was
it might have been a communal oven.
Okay.
It might have been something.
If it was a communal oven, right?
Yeah.
Should we assume that Gayim are going to fire their avodah zarah in this oven?
That still wouldn't make the oven aser. No.
Okay.
In other words, if a guy uses a hammer to make an idol,
okay,
right? That doesn't make the hammer aser.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there
something behind that question or no?
No, I don't.
No, I didn't know if there was sometimes you have a contemporary application.
So
the only way you could make that oven usher is if it belonged to the guy, he said to the oven, "You are my God," and he bows down to it.
So what is the problem then with this issue?
Well, so this case, however, the Jew put the gourd in the oven before the guy lights the oven, fires the oven, and the concern is the guy is cooking the gourd, which was not edible raw.
Right. That was my question.
He's taking something for avodah zarah and putting it in the oven.
What?
Isn't that what he's doing?
No.
Or he's just turning on the oven.
Yeah, the guy is trying to bake a peg. He's got a clay something. Okay. I'm sorry. So clay. He has a clay peg that he wants to dry out, and make solid in the oven. And then he didn't know that there was some food in there, but the Jew had put in there. And so the Gemara says it's not subject to the laws of Bishalakum. So the Gemara says the following: Pshita, of course, the guy wasn't trying to cook food. So the Gemara says the following: Mahu detema levashule mana kamechavein. You might think that the guy is actually coming. His purpose was to cook. The Gemara deliberately uses the word levashule to cook the kli. So kamash malan that lisharure mana kamechavein. He's actually trying to solidify the kli. Now this seems like a very strange statement, and in isolation it isn't actually very odd until you understand what the Gemara and Shabbos comments about this. Firstly, the words themselves. Bashule means literally to cook. Now, we usually think about cooking in terms of food. However, in the context of Hilchos Shabbos, Bishul actually has sort of two definitions. And if you think about it, when you cook food, you're actually doing one of two things when you're cooking food. You're either taking the hard and making it soft, or you're taking the soft and making it hard. It's different kinds of cooking. It depends what exactly nature is and what is the food that actually goes in there. But the definition in Hilchos Shabbos for Bishul is either l'rakech es hakasha or l'hakshos es harach.
Let's
change the solidness, to make it looser, to make it solider. That's what Bishul is classically defined as. So,
the
liquids. So leaving water out for the moment, in theory, although it's not detectable, I guess, it's a good question. I would say that when you cook a liquid, you're typically evaporating it, which you are actually making it denser. Right? Water is probably the exception to that rule. When you cook water, you may evaporate, but the water doesn't get any denser. But water itself in general is kind of sui generis within the laws of Bishul on Shabbos. It's a question, just to, by means of example, although this is, may not be agreed upon by all, there's a rule when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos that ein bishul achar bishul. Once something has been cooked, you cannot actually violate a malacha, certainly min ha-Torah, by cooking it a second time. And even though Ashkenazim, well, Asfardim also, are machmir on some level, that when it comes to things that have liquid in them, soup, for example, that we say there is bishul achar bishul, nonetheless, that's a minority opinion. Most Rishonim would say that there's no bishul achar bishul, whether it's a soup or whether it's a solid piece of meat. There is one possible exception to that rule, which is water. In other words, if you cook water and you boil it, which is its cooking, and then you let it cool down to room temperature, and then you cook it again, it is conceivable that most would agree that there's bishul achar bishul midaraisa there. Why? Because all other kinds of cooking fundamentally don't really transform the food that you're cooking. The one exception is water. At least to the naked eye, forget it might kill some bacteria in the water, but to the naked eye, you boil water and it cools down, it's exactly where it was when it started. Any other food after you cook and you let it cool down, it's not where it was when it started. So I suspect that when we talk about other, if Rishonim are thinking in that formulation of softening the hard, hardening the soft, it means making it denser. So probably with the exception of water, pretty much everything at least involves that type of a step.
You can use that argument to say that you can never cook water.
You're right on one's own. One might have actually made that argument, although it's clear from the Gemara that whether or not, however you figure it out conceptually, we have the case law to indicate that boiling water is special. Right, so you're either gonna you can try to stretch or bend the definition if you would like, and again, I've given you the definition for the purposes of this sugya and what the Rishonim point out in Shabbos about hardness and softness, and you can argue to me, well, water doesn't fit that pattern, so I'll make a different argument. Cooking typically transforms the food, right? But if that's the case, also water does fit the category, but it's clear it's under the category of bishul. So one of the things I would add in general in the discussion of Bishul, there's an assumption is that it has to use heat and that the food has to reach a certain temperature, of yatso ledespo, right, where the hand will get burned if you touch it. So water does not involve transformation, as we saw at the beginning of our sugya. Remember in the discussion of kimayim, ma'ayim shelo nishtana. Nonetheless, for whatever reason, water does seem to be an issa d'oraisa of Bishul on Shabbos. You can see it in, there are many, many, many sugyas assume that. Yom Kippur's coming up, so when they used to, they couldn't heat water, what they used to do for the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur in order to be able to have warm water in the mikveh, is they used to heat these ashashio sobazo, these large tongues of iron. They would heat, and then they would put into the mikveh on Yom Kippur morning, and that would warm, it wouldn't make the water hot, but it would warm up the water so it would not be uncomfortable for the Kohen Gadol. The only shot that the Gemara has is you might be, what's the term for tziruf? Tempering the iron. But the water is not reaching boiling. But the assumption is they couldn't actually boil water on Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is the same malachos as Shabbos. Whatever, and in the Beis HaMikdash, there are no shvusim. There are no rabbanans when it interferes with doing the avodah. So for whatever the reason is, and whether you create its own category, there is bishul on mine. So the Gemara says here, you might think that the guy was intending to cook the clay. What is he doing? He's taking this clay peg, and by baking it, he's making it solid. Now, what is the word l'sharure? So you might recognize the word. There's one context in which that root you hear frequently on very happy occasions. At the end of the reading of the ksuba, right before they get to the hakol, sharir v'kayam, right? Or you'll hear in kol nidre, lo shririn, v'lo kayamin. So sharir means to be strong or to be forced, in force. So it sounds like, so the Gemara says he's not intending to cook the kli, he's intending l'sharurei mana kamachavim. He's not interested in bishul, he's interested in solidifying the kli. Now that, based on what I just told you, that sounds a little bit funny, because that is one of the definitions of bishul. In fact, so much so that if you look in Rashi, Rashi writes that kamash melon de'ein bishul bekelim. Now that's a fascinating comment of Rashi, and most of the Rishonim say it's wrong. It's against the Gemara and Shabbos. And this, by the way, from a methodological perspective in learning, I like to point out to my students, one of the most crucial things, that difficulties in the Gemara, is when the Gemara presents a mahu detema, I would have said, the hava mina, and now it says, kamash malon, it teaches us that you don't, what is the kamash malon? What is it teaching us? I know what was said before isn't true, but the question is why. So the Gemara here said, "Ma'u d'tema that the guy is levashulei kamachavein, kamash malon l'sharurei kamachavein." And Rashi has said here, basically, you might have thought that the guy, not what his intent was, but that the guy was actually performing an act of bishul. Rashi says, "Kamash malon that there's no bishul b'kelim, that the guy, that all the guy did was solidifically, he wasn't mevashulei." So there are two problems with Rashi's interpretation. One, which is the more surprising one, is that when the Gemara says presents its words, it doesn't say kamash that mahu detema that the guy is mevashel, kamash malon that the guy is actually being misharer, he's not being mevashel. The Gemara says that I would have thought that the guy is levashulei kamechavein, his intent is for bishul, kamash malon his intent is for something else. The other problem is that the Gemara in Shabbos says that someone who takes a peg like this and he makes it, the Gemara lists a number of malachas that you theoretically violate in the process, one of which is bishul. So most Rishonim say that if you think about the flow of our Gemara, the issue is not what malacha is technically involved in actually solidifying this peg. There is no malacha, as far as I know, at least not by that label, of sharir, of being misharir on Shabbos. Now there is a malacha, it's probably called tikkun mana, or makeba patish. It's the idea of gemar kli, or gemar malacha, finishing an object. Right, there is such an idea, although the Gemara, I don't think I've used the term l'sharure, so it's not. It doesn't seem that the Gemara here is talking about what the guy actually did. What the Gemara is talking about is actually what the guy's intent was. And we know what the guy's intent was. The guy's intent was to solidify this peg. But the Gemara implies that whether or not this constitutes bishul almost depends on how people view what they are doing. Yes, of course, someone who doesn't know anything, and he puts his peg in the oven on Shabbos and solidifies it, he has technically violated many malachos, among which are actually bishul. But when you talk about lashon b'nei adam, how do people describe what they are doing? So the guy, doesn't say, oh, I'm cooking the pegs in the oven. He says, I'm firing the pegs in the oven, I'm solidifying the pegs in the oven. And therefore, at least in the context of bishul akum, the Gemara is saying that if people do not view this as bishul, then the goy's intent, even though technically it might be, from the perspective of Hilchos Shabbos, then it means that we don't treat it as if the goy actually did bishul. You know what the goy did is, he solidified a mana, a kli. What would a case be a problem? Let's say a goy puts a pot of soup in the oven to cook. And there was a gourd that was buried in the oven, and the guy had no idea that he was cooking this gourd. In that case, it's clear from the Gemara, even though the guy didn't intend to cook the Jew's gourd, nonetheless, it's considered bishul akum because the guy's intent was to do bishul. But in this case, because his intent was not to do bishul, his intent was to do something else that we call the sharurei mana, to strengthen a kli, therefore the Gemara says there's no problem of bishul akum.
Rabbi, what happens if his intent is just to heat something up?
You mean to heat something, a kugel that was already cooked, that was already baked?
Yeah.
I presume the answer would be it wouldn't be a problem, because the guy's intent, from two angles. Halachically speaking, it's not bishul, number one, because he's not, we would say on Shabbos, for example. You could take a kugel that was cooked before Shabbos, a dry kugel, and you put it on the fire, even though you violate in Isurim the Rabbanan, because it wasn't on the blast before Shabbos, or whatever else is required, you don't violate Bishul. There's no Isur Daraisa, because there is no Bishul by that kugel once it's been cooked.
About soup?
One second. Let me answer that question. The answer would presumably be the same thing. If the soup was cooked already, according to most Rishonim, that's not called Bishul. But that might be, but let me finish this half of the statement. Which is that, and then ask yourself the question, when somebody puts kugel in the oven, when it was baked already, would people describe that in Lashon B'nei Adam is cooking?
No.
itself.
No, you would say you're reheating the kugel. That's what you would say. You're heating the kugel. So I don't think in that case it would be it would constitute bishul akum if there was already something else buried there. I would argue that the question of soup, certainly in Lashon B'nai Adam, forget the halachic aspects, you don't cook soup once it's been cooked already. You reheat soup or you heat soup. I think the question one can ask is, if technically speaking there is an Isser of Bishul on Shabbos, if there's Bishul Achar Bishul by soup, which is a machlokes, should depend upon that question. If you believe that there is no Bishul Achar Bishul, even by liquids, then it's not Bishul, because it's not Bishul halachically, it's not Bishul in the way people describe it. If there is Bishul halachically, then it's conceivable that we would say that it also, if that's soup, in the context of Bishul Akum, if there was something else buried in the oven, it would constitute, it would be a violation of Bishul Akum. How hot? Assuming you bring it to Yad. Again,
you put it on the bluff. Bluff isn't supposed to be in there, right? So,
a bluff could heat the soup.
The bluff wasn't supposed to be hotter than you're putting your hand on it either.
No, absolutely not. The whole point of having the bluff is that you can put it on the fire that way. Right, because direct on the fire. There's a heker. That's the purpose of what we call. That's a heker required for chazara. Let's say if you're putting it back on. So the problem putting soup back on the blech where it can get really hot is not a problem. It's not a problem of what we call chazara. You can put a kugel there. The shaila by soup is whether or not it constitutes bishul the second time around. Once it reached room temperature, putting it back. You know, for Ashkenazim, for example, the Rama has a kula. He says that when it comes to bishul achar bishul by liquids, it's only if it's nitztanei legamrei. It's a very strange position. Only if it reaches room temperature. But according to the Rama, if the stuff is still warm, even though it's dipped below yatso levis, the temperature which you can, you know, could burn yourself theoretically on it, the Rama says as long as it's not nitztanei legamrei, we would say room temperature, there's no bishul achar bishul. You could put it right back on the hot spot. So in other words, but it's all dependent upon the question of bishul, achar bishul, you know, whether or not cooking liquids once they've been cooked is called bishul. Marshall?
Right, but just to double check, so I was always told that the halacha Friday nights, if you're serving soup off the blech, you have to take it off, have in mind that you're putting it back on, keep your hand on the pot, serve it off.
So that's complicated. That would not only be soup, that would be anything in theory. And there could be salads. It has nothing to do with bishul. It has to do with the laws of Shihan Chazara. So that is a big machlokas. The minhag of... I don't know, the Ramah quotes the minhag. You have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi. However, the Ramah quotes the... He doesn't like it, but he quotes the minhag. Let me backtrack for a second. What you're referring to, the idea that you have intent to put the soup back, it's still holding it in your hands, you're holding it, it hasn't been put down on the karka, and so on. All those are called the Tanoi Chazara, the requirements, the conditions required for Chazara. They're presented by the Gemara in the third parak in Shabbos. The Ran, however, based upon a Yerushalmi, claims that's only when it wasn't on the blech the entire Bein HaShemashas. It would mean, let's say Shabbos, you know, it's a weird case that it would come up. You took it off before Shabbos to start serving, and Shkia comes, right, and then, or... and then you want to put it back on. Then those are the requirements. But once you've had it on the blech, starting with Shkia, through Bein HaShemashas, and now let's say, for most of us, you don't get started eating until after Shabbos, according to the Ran, you can put it down on the counter, you can even theoretically have to change your mind and put it back on. As long as, for the Ramah, and that would be true with any foods, and if it's liquid, as long as it was not, it's down in the gamma, as long as it didn't reach room temperature. That's the position of the Ran, and the Ramah quotes it. He quotes it first, he quotes it in Hilchos Shabbos. He doesn't like it, but he acknowledges it's the minhag, and later in the siman, he quotes it again as the fact that it's the minhag. He knows that it's the minhag. It was the minhag lita, it was the Rav's practice. Others don't like this particular practice. So I don't know, it depends upon minhag, depends upon the you know, the local psak. But that's what that issue is dependent on, not so pashut. The other thing that many of us do, I mean, in this case, I didn't have a kula tradition from my home, but I had a kula tradition from my in-laws, so that's what we used to do. We don't use a blech anymore, we use a hot plate, and there are many who hold that by a hot plate, since nobody normally, you might be able to want some of them, but nobody cooks on a hot plate, there's no problem of chazara if you take it off, because it's not, the issur of chazara is because of mechzek mevashal, it looks like you're cooking. And since nobody cooks on a hot plate, the only shaila you actually have to deal with is bishul, meaning there are we have a hot plate where if you put the soup on the hot spot from out of the fridge, give it a few hours and it will actually be yatso ledes. So that you can't do because it's bishul. But in terms of the issue, if you have a food that was on there, taking it off, putting it back on, that's not even subject according to the rules of the Tanaim of Chazal.
You made the soup just hot, not just warm.
So it depends. If you put it in a place where even if you left it there for hours, it could not reach Yad Soledes, then that is mutter. If you put it in a place where it could reach, but you tend to pull it away, that's usur. Yeah.
They have the kosher warming drawers now.
The temperature, right. Now, so if you set this, right, there are, listen, we have two hot plates. We have these two, the technical warming trays. One of them gets pretty hot. The other one, even at the highest temperature, can warm things nicely, but it doesn't make them, I don't think it could, you know, reach the soup to a boil. Okay, so anyway. He wouldn't allow hot plates. On what grounds?
Ooh.
Okay.
My mother asked him once, and she's Rav Breuer.
Okay.
And he said,
I don't understand why somebody wouldn't allow a hot plate. Meaning, you could argue that you can't put stuff back on, but I understand. Okay. Anyway, fine. So for our purposes, by Bishul Akam, it seems that it has to be both. It has to be Bishul, and it has to be something people see as Bishul. But if it's cooking this earthenware peg, this clay peg, in order to make it solid, even though in Hilchos Shabbos we would technically consider it a violation of Bishul, because you're taking that which is soft and you're making it hard, nonetheless, it doesn't constitute Bishul for Bishul Akam purposes.
If the guy doesn't know that he's cooking the Jews' food, how will that lead to chasnas?
So again, once the gezeira, it's a good question. I think once the gezeira is made, it sort of fits in under a certain mold. So even if the guy doesn't happen to know it, but he actually cooked the food, we don't sort of make the fine distinctions. Okay, now the Gemara on the fourth wide line, on Lamed Chasam and Aleph, begins the next topic. Here now we're getting back into sort of more mainstream Bishul Akum. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Hiniach Yisrael Basar Agabe Gechalam. If a Jew puts meat on top of the coals, now I don't know, they're probably, I don't know if people do that quite today like this, but they used to actually put basar directly, the meat sometimes, no, directly on the coals. We call it basar agumre, is the expression. Today I think we generally tend to leave it a little bit, you know, put it on grates or something like that. I know maybe I know one of you is going to tell me, oh no, don't you know the latest thing in some of the restaurants is, you know, this is meat on the coals.
What about at a luau?
There we go. I said that was going to happen. I don't know. So anyway, if a Jew put the meat on the coals, uba ove kochavim v'havachbo, a guy comes along and he turns the meat over or he does something to it, mutter. There's no problem on bishulakim. So now the Gemara asks a very basic question. Hey chidami, what is the case here? Ilema the ilo hafachbe havel bashil. If it's a case where even if the guy had not come along and helped it along, the food would have cooked anyway. It didn't make a difference. So pshita, of course, why should it be prohibited to eat it? What did the guy do? He turned the meat over very nice. It was going to cook anyway. El alav must be the ilo hafach had the guy not do it. Lo have a bashil, it would not have cooked. So then the Gemara says, I'm my mutter.
So how's the basis?
Bishule shalakum then who? And why should it be permitted? Basically, without the guy's work, the food would not have cooked. In other words, the Jew... let me formulate that carefully. Once the Jew left the scene, left to its own devices, this meat would have remained uncooked. Now, the non-Jew came along and did something to ensure that the meat cooked. Without his action, the meat would not have cooked. Okay, so that's a problem. So the Gemara says, it's bishalakum. Why is it permitted? Lo tzricha. The Gemara says, no, you know what the case is? The ilo hafach have bashel bitarte shah. It would have cooked in 2 hours, and now because he does it, it will cook in 1 hour. I would have thought that making something cook faster is milsa, it's a thing. Literally, it's a thing. Kamash malan, that what?
It's not a thing.
The question here again is, what is the kamash malan? Is it that karuve bishule means nothing, or is that it doesn't matter in our context for bishul akum? Right? We have a lot of leniencies by bishul akum, and maybe this is one more. So the Ritva points to a Gemara in Shavuos at the end of the second parak, and the Gemara in Shavuos is talking about a non-kohen who does avoda. And there are four avodos. Most ritual service in the temple were limited to kohanim. There are a few things that non-kohen can do, but most things could only be done by a kohen. Of the things that could only be done by a kohen, so if a non-kohen does them, the avoda is invalid. In a handful of cases, the zar, the non-Kohen who does that particular service, is actually chayev misa bidei shamayim. He's liable for the heavenly death penalty. And one of those avodos is burning limbs on the Mizbeach. Okay? Haktaras emuim. So that is an avoda that has to be done by a Kohen. Ironically, for those of you who may be a little familiar with Kudshim, failing to burn the limbs on the Mizbeach does not prevent the carbon from being good. Once the blood has been thrown properly of a carbon, nothing that happens afterwards will invalidate the sacrifice, and the owner will not have to bring another sacrifice. But there's still a mitzvah to burn the designated parts on the Mizbeach, and it is an avoda that has to be done by a Kohen. And if a non-Kohen does it, he is chayev misa bidei shamayim. He's liable for the heavenly death penalty. So the Gemara in Shavuos talks about the following case. Supposing they put they threw some of the limbs on the fire, and now a Jew comes along, takes out the metal thing, whatever it's called. What's that? Whatever the thing is, any a large metal fork or whatever it is, and he moves the meat around to make it burn quickly, more quickly. So Rav says that being Mekarev the Bishul, Mekarev the Haktara, in fact, the Zahar has done an avoda and he's chai misha bidei shamayim, even though the limb would eventually have burnt on its own.
A little harsh.
What's that?
It's a little harsh.
That's also contradictory.
That's what he's raising it to.
So the Ritva says, you have to understand, it's not that Karuve Bishula doesn't have a status, it just means in the context of Bishul Akum, they weren't gozer. Here, I'll invoke the suggestion someone asked before, but if the guy does it, you know, if the guy does it, the Jew's going to say, big deal. I didn't need his help. It was going to cook anyway. So that's why I say it's crucial to understand when the Gemara says, Kamash Malan what? Okay, we know that there's no Bishul Akum, but why not? Is it because speeding up the Bishul actually does not constitute anything? Or is it that it simply doesn't constitute a problem in this particular context? To give an example, which I think, I don't remember this being discussed in Shulchan Aruch, but one of the possible test cases would be the following. Go to Shabbos. Now, let's assume for the moment, it's not entirely, let's assume for the moment that on Shabbos, there is no bishul once something is cooked, and the definition of cooked is Mahal Ben Drusai. We spoke about this last week. Let's say, for the way Rashi says, one third of the cooking, once that's done, it's considered edible enough that there is no bishul after that. So what happens if on Shabbos the food is sitting on the fire? Okay, whether it was proper or not proper, nobody, it was put on before Shabbos, not a problem. Left for another half hour, the food will cook. It will move from before Mahal Ben Drusai to after Mahal Ben Drusai. And now someone comes along and he turns the item without taking it off the fire. So at no point, the bishul, if you take it off the fire, do something to it, and then put it back on, of course you violate bishul on Shabbos. Because once you took it off the fire, freeze the frame, it's not going to cook anymore unless you put it on the fire. So you have obviously done bishul. But let's say you never remove it from the fire, but you just turn it in such a way that now instead of cooking in half an hour, it's going to cook in 15 minutes. So one would think that the two readings of this Gemara, the two ways of reading it, should determine whether or not you have violated Bishul on Shabbos. If you believe that this Gemara is in contradiction with the Gemara in Shavuos, and this Gemara believes that Karuve Bishule, causing the cooking to happen, which would have happened anyway, but causing it to happen faster, does not constitute cooking, then you wouldn't be chayev at least mid to orais on Shabbos. If, however, you believe that all the Gemara means to say is that in the context of Bishul Akum, they don't treat this as Bishul, so then it is conceivable, just as we have other differences with Hilchos Shabbos, that this is another difference, and that only in the sugya of Bishul Akum would we say that this is not considered Bishul. Okay.
Does Rashi say at any other place there's no Bishul, Caleb?
I think the only other place would come up in that Gemara and Shabbos, but that Gemara and Shabbos is explicit. It's explicit. Okay. So now the Gemara asks a question. V'ha'amar Rav Asi Amar Rav Yochanan Kol shehu kemachol ben drusai ein bo mishum bishulei akum. Okay, so Rav Yochanan says that anything that has been cooked already to machol ben drusai, a third or a half of its cooking, there's no bishulak. The guy comes and he cooks it the rest of the way, there's no problem. So the Gemara infers from Rabbi Yochanan's statement, Ha, eino kamachol ben drusai, if it weren't yet kamachol ben drusai and the guy cooked it, yesh bo mishum bishulei akum, then there would be a violation of bishulakum. So why in this case if the assumption is, if a Jew put the basar on the coals, and now a guy stokes them or turns the meat over in a way that it cooks faster, why is assuming that he got to it before the meat had reached the stage of Machan ben Dusai, does Rabbi Yochanan not imply that in fact there would be a problem with Bishalakum? And the truth is, I read this question, I didn't think it was a very good question, and I think the Gemara's answer makes clear why. The Gemara answers, Hasam kigon da osve besilta vishakle oveit kochavim va osve betanura. No, that's a case where the thing was partially cooked, yes, it wasn't kamacho ben drusai yet, and then it wasn't in the oven. Somebody put it, Rashi says, silt is a basket. It's sitting in a basket. It's not going to cook anymore on its own. Now the guy takes it and puts it in the oven. So obviously there, without the guy doing it, it wouldn't have cooked. But we're talking about a case where the Jew put it on the coals. It would have cooked. Left alone, no interference, it will cook on its own. So in our case, of course, it's permissible. What Rabbi Yochanan was saying is that if the food was kamacho ben drusai, and then you take it out of the oven, and then the guy puts it back in, there's no bishalakim. Why? Because it was already edible. It was already kamacho ben drusai. But if it wasn't kamacho ben drusai, and it was not in the oven, then on its own, it's never going to cook. So then if the guy puts it in the oven, the guy is the one who actually cooked the food, and it would be subject to the strictures of bishalakim. And now the Gemara confirms that. Tanya nami hachi, meniach Yisrael basar agabe gecholim, uva oved kochavim mahapech bo, ad sheyavo Yisrael mi beis haknesses o mi beis hamedrash, ve'eno choshesh. So this is very interesting. The Gemara says that you can put the meat on the coals, and you can have a non-Jew come and flip the meat or something like that until the Jew gets back from shul or from the Beis Medrash, and you don't have to worry. Eino choshesh means you're not worried about bishul akum. Similarly, shofeses isha kidera agabe kira, a woman can put a pot on top of the stove, ubos ovde kochavim, and a non-Jewish woman can come, umegisa, and she can stir the pot, acha tavo mi beis hamerchatz, oh, mi beis haknesses, ve'eino chosheshes. Okay, and you're not concerned. So, Adrian, you're shaking your head there. And there are a couple. It's fascinating here. Embedded are a few different stereotypical assumptions, which today may not always be the same. The first one I find interesting is that the man is what we would call in our family is the Fleisch cooker. He's the one in charge of grilling, and the woman is in charge of the cooking. So, in my house, it used to be the case. I used to be the meat person. Not anymore. I'm no longer entrusted with that. But that does seem to be a fairly common stereotype. Of the man is the one who does the grilling. Adrian, who does the grilling in the family? And who does the cooking? Yeah. There you go. See? So some things have just not changed. So that's question number one. Now, the second assumption buried there is, I think, sort of a sociological assumption of who socializes with whom. And it's the men with the men and the women with the women. So it's the Jew who sets the grill, or maybe it's just because if you need a guy to be finishing the grilling, it also has to be a man, because men do the grilling. One of those two assumptions. In addition, the assumption of where were they coming from. So the both cases, they could have been coming from shul. In the case of the man, the assumption is he might have been coming from the Beis HaMedras, and the assumption of the woman, she could have been coming from the Beis HaMerchatz. Baruch Hashem, that has changed. And that assumption, in one sense, that assumption is no longer safe about the woman. Unfortunately, it's changed the other way also. One cannot be reasonably certain that the man is coming from the Beis HaMedras. He could be coming from the football game. So anyway, so that's what the Gemara says. But this demonstrates that as long as the Jew starts the cooking in a way, he puts the meat down, it's really the first half of the brisa. He puts the basar al gabe gecholim, and then the guy can come along, kimi mahapech, and that's not a problem. As long as the Jew starts the cooking, and the cooking could have finished on its own without the intervention of the non-Jew, then even though the non-Jew might be speeding up the process, it doesn't actually matter. Okay. Fine. Now, obviously, one of the directions that the Gemara is now going in, and this is a crucial question halachically, is the question of how much participation does a Jew have to have in the process of cooking to do away with the problem of bishalakum. And I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, that the practice among Ashkenazim is that even if they turn on the stove, in fact, I told a story about a particular restaurant, and I wondered. I suddenly wondered whether it was still in existence. Unfortunately, I had to pay a shiva call in Fairlawn on Friday, and we passed by, so I discovered the Chinese place is still there. So Anyway, so I remember, as I told the story, that we were picking up some food, and then you could see into the kitchen, and the fire went out, and the non-Jewish worker called the mashgiach over to relight it. So Ashkenazim work with the assumption that if the Jew turns on the flame, that is sufficient. Not only that, apparently, but this is not as common, because the way we fuel our fires, the Rishonim talk about, and we'll read it a little later, I think, about simply throwing a twig into the fire. Right? In other words, if the guy did everything, he lit the fire, he put the food on the fire, he stirs the pot, but a Jew comes along and throws a little twig into the fire, which adds a tiny bit to the fire, which really makes absolutely no difference in a practical sense. The Jew's participation was essentially totally irrelevant, had no impact. Nonetheless, the minhag and ashkenaz seemed to have been that rendered the food permitted as well. But today, you know, there at least is a much stronger basis if the Jew lights the fire. But for us, and that's what we would do typically today. But obviously, for us, I don't think it's a good idea to throw a twig onto your stove, you know, as your means of avoiding bishul akum.
Svardim have a different minhag, or
Svardim are much more machmir. We'll talk about it as we get through the sugya. It's a question of how to read the Gemara. Svardim are much more machmir, which, as I mentioned, presents a problem. For Sephardim eating in kosher restaurants, because almost all the kosher restaurants, Hashgacha, relies upon the leniencies of Bishul Akum that Ashkenazim have. Someone told me that Chacham Ovadia has a tshuva which he, I think, says that Sephardim can be makel in this type of a situation, but Al Pidin, and this is one case, it's rare, it's one case in Yeridea where Ashkenazim are much more lenient than Sephardim. Usually it's the reverse. Marshall?
But wouldn't the modern equivalent of throwing a twig on, I mean, since it's really just a legal fiction of participating in the cooking, to be doing virtually anything, salting the omelet at the end, throwing chives on, adjusting the flame.
So again, I say, die de lolosif, right? In other words, it seems that the kula that existed was one that entailed manipulating either the fire or the food when it was on the fire. Now, you're raising a very interesting question, which is a big machlokas harishonim, on the previous Gemara. It's clear from the Gemara that if the food isn't yet bishul akum, Machu Ben Rusai, excuse me. It hasn't reached Machu Ben Rusai. And then the Jew finishes the job. Certainly, that's not going to be a problem, right? But if the food wasn't Machu Ben Rusai, and now the guy finishes the job, that will be a problem. What about the following case? Let's say a guy cooks the food, and he gets it past Machu Ben Rusai, but it's not fully cooked yet. And then a Jew comes along, and he actually finishes the cooking. What's the din then? So there are Rishonim, a number of Rishonim, who say that it's usur, which in a sense is the intuitive logical position. In other words, once the food is cooked, there's nothing more you can do. It's cooked, and the guy was the one who cooked it in this case, so it should be usur. But the Ritva says, and I don't know what I don't remember how we pass on Shulchan Aruch, I think we're lenient. The Ritva says, no, that even if it was Kimacha Mendrusai in the hands of the guy already, if a Jew actually comes and finishes the cooking, that's also good. That's also good.
I mean, I guess it rests on whether the twig case specifically says it has to be pre-Machu Ben Rusai.
You
already know how they've done.
Correct. But either way, so you're correct that there are, we have many, many leniencies by Bishul Akum. We're almost looking for reason to be makel. You know, it does seem to be that at least it's something that has to be done between the beginning of the cooking and when it is fully cooked. And
fire.
What's that? And involve the fire, or involve putting the food on, or involve stirring the food.
Participation on some level.
Right. The question, I don't know, Marshall asked the question. Let's say the Jew comes along and just adds a little salt in there. I'm not sure.
It's still participation.
The Jew participates
in some way.
I'm not sure. In other words, the twig is the biggest legal fiction, because really, theoretically, I'm sure that some scientists will tell us it trims 3.5 seconds off the cooking, you know, because there's a little more fire or something like that. I understand the process of stirring. I understand putting the food on, even putting the food back on if it's Kamacha Ben Drusai. I understand lighting the fire. I understand adding real wood to the fire when the fire's starting to go down and you need it. The twig is an unusual kula. That's not the real problem, however, as we'll see for the Sephardim. The problem isn't the twig kula, because in other words, what restaurants rely upon is the Jew lighting the fire. And that, as we'll see, the Gemara will mention as a leniency, but the question is, where does that leniency actually apply? So now the Gemara says as follows. Second line from the top of Lamed Chesamid Beis. Ibai lehu, hiniach obet kochavim v'hafach Yisrael mahu. If the guy put the food on the stove, and now the Jew puts the meat on the coals, and the Jew turns the meat over to speed the cooking up. So now, if you think about it, in this scenario, the food would have cooked anyway. It's just going to cook faster now with the Jew doing it. Now, the Gemara doesn't say, is this a case where the Jew turns it over before it reaches Machlo Ben Drusai, or only after? Because in a sense, that's the root of the Machlokas of the Rishonim. So we don't know. However, the Gemara wants to know, let's to keep things safe, let's say the Jew turned the meat over before Machlo Ben Drusai. So the Jew's participation in speeding up the cooking took place before the food could be legitimately labeled, or possibly labeled as cooked. So what's the din? So the Gemara says the following. Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Kavachomer. Gomro b'yad akum mutar, gomro b'yad Yisrael lo kol shekei. If it was completed by the non-Jew, and that is considered permissible, isn't it a kal v'chomer if the Jew completes it that it's permissible? So the simpler reading of this Gemara, it would seem to be, although there may be other ways of reading it, would suggest, in fact, that the Ritva is correct. Which is that it doesn't really matter if the food was cooked to Machlo Ben Drusai all the way through Machlo Ben Drusai by a non-Jew. If a Jew comes along afterwards and he actually is responsible for the food being finished cooking, that it's certainly, in other words, it's true Machlo Ben Drusai brings the food to an edible state. But the reality is, most of us don't want to eat our food to Machlo Ben Drusai. We've discussed steaks already. I'm with you on that one, although I don't know what Machlo Ben Drusai exactly is. However, the rest of our foods, we don't like to eat Machlo Ben Drusai. I don't think you like eating, you know, a half-baked kugel, or third-baked kugel. So the point is that if Machlo Ben Drusai, if reaching it to Machlo Ben Drusai at that stage is considered cooking, certainly when the person really renders it into its final and finest form, that should be permissible. If the Jew does that part, certainly the food should be good. So that is what the Gemara says. Amar Rabba Barchana, Itmar Nami, it was also said, the same thing. Amar Rabba Barchana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, V'Armi La Amar Rabbi Achaba Barchana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bein Sheheniach Oved Kochavim V'Hafach Yisrael, Bein Sheheniach Yisrael V'Hafach Oved Kochavim, Mutar. It's permissible either way. It doesn't matter who puts it on and who turns it over. Doesn't make a difference. I think what this means, by the way, this is interesting. You could have, I'm waiting for the clever person to say, but what if the guy did the beginning and he did the end, but the Jew did the middle? So does the Gemara mean to exclude that would be prohibited? I think the answer is no. Right? If the Gemara is working with sort of a binary state, there's beginning, there's end, the guy does one, the Jew does one. In order for it to be usher, the guy has to do mitchilaso v'yad sofo. Okay. So now here comes the really important line in the Gemara. Amar Ravina, Hilchasa, the halacha is as follows. Ha rifta. What is rifta? Bread. Now this is a little strange, because bread is making a comeback, right? Pasakam was a sugya a couple of blot earlier. All of it, we're in the middle of sugya of Bishalakam, and all of a sudden, Pas makes an appearance on stage. Horifta de Shagar Oveit Kochavim Va'afar Yisrael. If the guy fired the oven up, that's what Shagar means. Your Shogar Etanor. He fires up the oven and the Jew bakes the bread. It means the Jew puts the bread in and it bakes. The Jew fires the oven, and the guy bakes it. Inami, here's the part. Shagar oved kochavim, v'afar kochavim. The guy does both, but v'asi Yisrael in between. V'chata bochetuye. He comes and he stokes the coals in the oven. Shapir dummy. I mean, obviously, this is an interesting case because I get the sense. I learned some very important things when I was in Camp Stone last summer, when I looked at their bread baking oven, and they have a brick oven that they built. Those of you who know Camp Stone, you might not be surprised that that's what they do, that kind of thing there. It's a real brick oven, and the way they actually fire it sometimes is they fire up the oven, they burn the fuel. And at some point, they rake the coals out, and then they bake the bread. You don't need the coals in the oven at the time. Now, sometimes they have to add and have to reheat the oven. So in theory, in the case of the Gemara, it sounds like you really still, they were baking with the coals in the oven, not simply relying upon the heat that's stored in the oven walls. Now, I know if I pointed this out, but those of you wonder how they used to ever do, how they used to have a hot food on Shabbos. When the Gemara talks about it, the answer is they had brick ovens, and the brick ovens can hold their heat for a day. In other words, those ovens are so thick, and long after the fire has been extinguished or has gone out, the oven is actually still hot. So that's how, when you learn Hilchos Shabbos, you know, and before modern technology where you had a continuous fuel supply where you could, you know, leave the flame on from before Shabbos and it's burning the same way it was on Shabbos, that's the way you used to have theoretically hot food during the day. So here, apparently, there were coals in the oven. The Jew did not put the bread in. The Jew didn't fire the oven. The Jew didn't put the bread in, but he comes along and he stokes the coals. So in this case, Ravina said, Shapir Dami. It is permissible. So the Gemara says this particular... So the Gemara says that it has a tremendous leniency here. A Jew can do one of Gimel Malachos. The Ran that we looked at before the end of the summer talks about the Gimel Malachos of Pas. The Gemara never uses the term, but he's referring to this Gemara. There are three things you do in Pas. You fire the oven, you put the bread in, and you stoke the coals. If a Jew does any one of the three, then the Gemara says it's not a problem. So the question is, what is this Gemara doing here? What is the Gemara doing here? After all, we're not talking about Pas. And we know that there are many more leniencies when it comes to the bread of a non-Jew than when it comes to what the Mishnah calls shlakos, the cooked food. Right? We distinguish between bishul and afia, between bread basically and all other foods, bread and cake versus all other foods. So the way the Rishonim of Ashkenaz understand is that the Gemara presents this here because the leniencies that this particular leniency that exists by Pasakum exists by Bishul Akum as well. In other words, you're right, this really doesn't belong here, except for we have a leniency when it comes to baking bread, that any one of the three malachos is enough. The same leniency then applies not just to Pas Akum, but even to Bishul Akum. That's one way of understanding the Gemara. And that's why, even though the bread part doesn't really belong here, the Gemara just gave us the example by bread. But the same thing would hold true by you cooking a pot of soup. If the Jew lights the fire, if the Jew puts the pot of soup on, or if the Jew comes along and he stokes the fire while the soup is cooking, any one of those three should be sufficient. And that's where the position of the Rishonim of Ashkenaz comes from, that the Rama quotes and that we rely upon today. The second approach is that of the Ran, which we mentioned. I just want to explain now that we've gotten to this Gemara. Everybody, except for the Ran, says that Bishul, that when we talk about the prohibition of Bishul Akum and the prohibition of Pas Akum, we're talking fundamentally about the same thing. The Goy takes the raw material and he transforms it either into a Tavshil, into something which was cooked, or he transforms it into Pas, into bread. And we have more leniencies by bread than we do by cooking. For example, industrial bread, commercial bread, the pas palter. We permit pas palter, we permit a baker's bread, we don't permit a private balabais's bread. But when it comes to bishul cooking, it makes no difference whether it's private or industrial, it's prohibited. So most Rishonim say that when we talk about the Isser of, let's say, of a non-Jew's bread, it's the same thing as Bishul Akum in the sense that if the guy bakes the bread for you, that's Asser. What happens if you go into the supermarket and you buy a dough, you know, frozen pizza dough? So all the Rishonim would say, that's not a problem with Pas Akum. The guy didn't make the bread, he made the dough. You take the dough, you take it home, you put it in your oven, you made the bread, not a problem. It doesn't matter, even if a private balabas made that dough, your neighbor makes a dough, and they give it to you, there's not a problem. The Ran, however, says the following. The Ran says, no. The prohibition of Pas Akum has nothing to do with baking bread and making bread edible. Pas Akum, says the Ran, is making the dough and preparing it for baking. And if the guy mixes the water and the flour, and kneads it, and arranges it for you, and all you have to do is cook it. So you go into the store and you can buy, you know, a pre-made pizza, let's say, all ready to take and just stick in your oven and bake it. The Ran says, that's Pas Akum, making the dough. What about cooking, baking the dough and transforming it? The Ran says, that's called Bishul Akum. Bishul applies both to what we call cooked foods, and it applies to bread as well. Meaning, even if a Jew makes the dough, and then the Jew, and then a guy takes the dough as it is, and he fires the oven, and the guy sticks it in the oven, and the guy is the one who stokes the coals. The guy does everything from the time you give him the raw dough. The Ran says that's a problem of bishulakum. Bishulakum is not limited to soups and to kugels and things like that. Bishulakum means taking food. Doesn't matter what the food is. That's inedible raw. That is olal shulchan malachim. It can be served at a fancy meal. And transforming it through heat into an edible form. There's no difference between bread and we call cooked stuff. Pasachum, the Ran says, refers to making the dough. And that's how the Ran explains the Gemara here. You want to know, what is this line doing here about the Gimel Malachos? Yeah, the Ran says, that's a din of Bishulachum. The Gemara chose an example of bread. But the Ran says, bread is not any different than any other type of food stuff. All of the other Rishonim who deny that position of the Ran, who claim that making a dough is nothing, it doesn't count as anything, and Pasachum and Bishulachum both refer to the cooking and baking process, they have to explain why does this appear here and not in the primary sugya of Pasachum? Because according to those Rishonim, this bread, when the guy does all three malachos, this is Pasachum, not Bishulachum. According to the Ran, this is Bishulachum, not Pasachum, and that's why it's sitting in the middle of the sugya of Bishulachum. Marshall?
Given the distinction between Bishul and Athiya is replete kind of all through all these sugyas in the Gemara, what's the Ran's analytic distinction from essentially, he's not only being cholek on other Rishonim, he's really almost being cholek on sort of the base of the Gemara. What's his analytic justification for saying, I alone view of, you know, Athiya as Bishul?
So I think the answer is firstly, Athiya is not always distinct from Bishul. Shilcha Shabbos, the Malacha is listed as Ofeh, and the Gemara points out in the Mishkan it was actually Mevashel, it was Bishul, just the Tana in the Mishnah wants to list the 11 Malachas of bread. Sidur the Pas. So Hilcha Shabbos, Bishul and Afiyah are one and the same. That's number one. So not all areas of Halacha. We discussed last week whether when it comes to Basar B'Chalav, it's not clear. Afiyah might or might not have the same din as Bishul. There's a question when it comes to Erev Tavshilin, the Machlokas are Rishonim, but some Rishonim say Afiyah and Bishul fall under the same category. Maybe Machlokas Bishal, maybe Sil, actually. So it's not clear that Afiyah had different is than Bishul. That's point number one. So it's not really an inconceivable position to argue that they're one and the same for Bishulakim purposes. Number two, I think it's the sugya, the structure of the sugya, that is what's driving the Ran. I think if the Ran hadn't, if it weren't for this Gemara, the Ran would probably have said like the rest of the Rishonim. But because this Gemara is totally out of place,
is literally his justification. The fact that this three lines of text,
I believe so,
proves that everyone's wrong and really be shown to be the same person.
That's what I believe. Look at the Ran on the Rift. That's his Raya. And ironically, as we pointed out in the last couple weeks, there are difficulties in that we read the Ran the earlier sugya, because the reason why they permitted commercially baked bread was the lack of availability, you know, for the Talmidim when people were in the Sada. So the truth is, if people were in the Sada, right, and did they have their ovens to bake with them, they just needed the dough from the non-Jew. That's what the Ran would essentially be claiming. He's claiming that all those leniencies have passed. And the Ran is a tremendous, tremendous chumrah. The Ran would say, you could go into the store and buy that bread, you know, whatever that dough was made because it was commercially made. But he would say that if to go to a to buy bread that's kosher from a non-Jewish bakery, but you know, let's say you go to buy an Italian bread, and it was all owned and cooked and everything else by a non-Jew, the Ran would say that that's usher. It's a tremendous, tremendous stringency. We don't accept the Ran, but nonetheless, I think it's the sugya that's what he says. It the sugya is really what pushes him in that direction. You know, yeah. So the answer is, in principle, yes. Meaning, there are sort of two ways of getting around the problem. Way number one, or maybe three ways. Way number one is that if you're dealing with foods that are either edible raw or are not olal shulchan malachim, we saw that was the Gemara in the previous Amud, if they're not, they can't be served, let's say, at a fancy meal, then there's no problem with bishulakim in the first place. Possibility number two is to devise an alternative means of cooking that doesn't involve the fire, which could be the microwave. It doesn't work for everything, but there's some things that should also not constitute a problem. I don't remember if we passed in this way. Maybe smoking is also not a problem. That there's a Yushalmi that says that ishun, that smoking the food is not a problem. We know that salting the food is not a problem if that's the way it's prepared. And I raised the possibility in the last couple, 2 weeks ago, I think, the possibility of induction cooking. It's not clear whether that would be cooking either, because there's no fire involved, nothing that constitutes fire. But if you're talking about either a gas range or an electric range where the stuff can glow hot you know, red hot. So that's considered Aish. So then the only way to do it is to have the Jew turn it on. As I mentioned last week or the week before, it used to be in the old days when we still had pilot lights in ovens, it wasn't such a big deal because the pilot light was always on. So if as long as it's just it's an extension of that fire, it wasn't actually a problem. But today, I think for energy purposes, they don't sell pilot lit ovens anymore. So you have electric ignition. So that is an issue. Then the Jew would at least have to turn the oven on and the range on or the oven on the ranges are typically often commonly gas, but would have to turn that on first, and then that would obviate the problem. Yeah.
How about what Marshall was saying before? Let's say the guy turns on, and then you go over later, and you
stir the pot. That would also solve the problem.
Turn it off. That's
that?
Like stoking the
That's flame. Like stoking the flame as well. If you turn the flame up, yes, that would also be the case. So there are ways around it. What the difficulty is in a situation where the Jew is not around at all. Right? That's the situation that's difficult, where the pilot light once made life easier, and now you don't have that leniency.
So the Chaira, pretty much everyone who has their babysitters making food for their kids on the stove.
Not baking, you mean cooking. In some cases, yes. In other words, if the food, again, you have to look at what food is being made. Now, if they're cooking some noodles or some rice for the kids,
or if it's leftovers and they're just reheating.
No, that's not even a question. But
no,
you're cooking based off that may not be olal shulcha melachim. But if you're talking about cooking something that's olal shulcha melachim, edible raw, that is a problem, right? The second question that emerges is what's the din of the kalim? That's a separate question. Maybe we'll get to discuss that particular issue. But that's a machlokas harishon.
There's an app now where you can stove remotely.
Well, the caterers do that. Kosher caterers.
We had.
Well, they're very careful.
The Mizgir turns it on remotely.
Really?
That's
okay.
That's what
we had once discussed whether Rabbanus Kochavim includes Christians.
For this, it doesn't matter because the pro. All right, so I think I know you've said this a while ago. We always talk about Bishul Akum, but that's a censor's term. The term, actual correct term, is either Bishul Nachri or Bishul Goy. The concern, for example, the Me'iri, and we spoke about this Me'iri a long time ago in the early parts of the Masechta, the Me'iri, whom many of us are very attached to, who claims that the Gemara's laws, when it comes to Akum, only apply to their Goyim, not to our Goyim, because our Goyim are civilized, and they have laws, and they have religion. So the Me'iri singles out certain exceptions. I don't remember if he mentions this, but it's a given that this is an exception because here the concern is not about Avodah Zarah. The concern is not about equal treatment or that he behaves properly. The concern is chasnus, intermarriage, and that's applicable regardless of whether or not he's a monotheist or not a monotheist. The interesting question that comes up, and it's a machlokas haposkim, for example, when it comes to wine touched by a non-observant Jew. So the Gemara says that a mechal Shabbos b'farhesya is dino ka'akum. So the question is, what happens if he touches the wine? So it was the machlokas, the Rav and Ramosha. The Rav was Mekel, Ramosha was Machmer. I think the Meganar community is to be Mekel. And the truth is, that's the position that makes intuitive sense. In this case, it doesn't matter if a mechal Shabbos is dino ka'akum. For the purposes, the reason why we have, I'll leave out Stam Yenim for the moment, but Bishul Akum and Pas Akum, the reason why those are prohibited is because of Chasnus. You're allowed to marry, non-from Jew. It might make an interesting kind of marriage where one is from, you have to, these marriages exist. It's not like you can't have it.
They exist.
I understand they exist. I got that part. But the point is that you can't argue that it should be a problem of Bishul Akum, the non-from partner cooking, because they're allowed to be married in the first place. So you can't, it's hard to imagine anybody would say that this is Shuv Chasmus. But by the same token, the non-Jew who might be 100% the monotheist and keeps all the Sheva Mitzvot is subject, because again, the Akum in this case is the censor's term. It's a judicial. You look in the first edition, printed edition of the Shulchan Aruch, and sometimes certain texts that have escaped censorship, it's either Bishul Goy or Bishul Nachum.
So if you're Polish, you can't let a Hungarian Jew.
You know, I'm half Hungarian, but that's okay. I know. So we say, when it comes to what's that? We say that Hungarianness is like Mamzerus, Hakola lechachar apogum, and it always follows. If you're 1% Hungarian, you're 100% Hungarian. Okay.
We can learn Torah.
Got it. Okay. You don't know whether you'd want to eat my food, and if you might enjoy the red velvet wallpaper in the kitchen. Okay. Fine. As much as my wife does not have honey Hungarian blood. Unfortunately, I passeled my children. What can I do? Okay. Fine. So now the Gemara, just a little bit further in the Gemara. So anyway, so our issue, Ashkenazim rely upon this Gemara not only by Pasachim but by Bishalachim as well, that if a Jew does any of the three malachos, which most often could be stoking the coals or, you know, adjusting the fire or certainly turning on the fire, or, you know, so then we assume that it's permissible.
Even turning it off.
What's that?
And turning it off.
No, turning it off wouldn't matter. Unless what you could do if the guy started, because you could turn the fire off and then turn back on. But that's even better than the Gemara, because there, once you turn it off, the cooking is stopped and it will not cook. So when you turn the fire on, you're actually doing 100% of the cooking. Okay.
It depends when you do that. If you do that after it's a third or a half cooked.
Right, except, but one would still, I think we assume that even if it's already Kamachal Ben Drusai, if the Jew comes along and speeds the cooking up, that also would avoid the problem. So in case once you turn it off, it will take till infinity for the food to cook right now to full cooking, but if you turn the fire on, it now will happen. So that certainly should work. If you take a look at the top Tosfos, Tosfos says, V'asa Yisrael v'chate chatuye b'gecholim. So Tosfos writes, Mikula shmaitin, from the entire sugya, mashma de'be'inan she'ehei ha'Yisrael mikarev ha'bishul k'tzas. Sounds like the Jew at least has to cause the cooking to happen a little faster, right? It's got to be something you can recognize. Umashe nohagu lahashlech kiseim latanur, the minag of just throwing a twig into the oven, onto the fire. Somchin almashe yesh bidvarim shebein b'nei bavel b'nei Eretz Yisrael. There apparently was a halacha work which outlined the differences between b'nei bavel and b'nei Eretz Yisrael. De ka'amar b'nei bavel mashlichim kiseim latanur, u'b'nei mariv omrim kiseim zeh Mala, mamala, umamorid. It says that Bnei Bavel used to throw a twig into the fire, into the oven, and that was sufficient. Bnei Marav, Bnei Eretz Yisrael said, "What does a kisim do? It doesn't do anything for you." V'onu nimshachim achar Bnei Bavel v'talmudam. We follow Bnei Bavel and their Talmud. I would just conclude by noting two things. Number one, it's interesting because, if anything, it is not uncommon for certain Minhagi Ashkenaz to actually come from Italy coming from Eretz Yisrael. If you take just one very common example, Yamin Rarayim are coming up. Now, if I'm not mistaken, although it's not true for all Sephardim, if you're looking to get out a little faster on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you might want to daven with Sephardim, because they don't say very much in the way of piyut. Now, if you look forward, if it's the highlight of the davening, Unisana Tokef, I don't think the real Sfardim do Unisana Tokef either. I don't mean Nusach Sfard, I mean real Sfard. Sfardim don't do Piyut. Piyut is an interruption in the middle of davening. Ashkenazim have done Piyut for a very long time. Ashkenazim were following the practice of Eretz Yisrael, and Bavel and Sfardim found their roots in Bavel. The way we like to say is that Bavel was a little like Eastern Europe, all they did was the Gemara, and Eretz Yisrael was like Western Europe, where they actually had a much broader curriculum. They were interested in Tanakh, that's where our Sifrei Tanakh were finalized, although with this week's news of the discovery of on that scroll, we know things that our Tanakh is, in its final form, is much older than we thought. And Eretz Yisrael, they were writing Piyut, they were writing this, you know, this liturgical poetry, and they were more interested in broader things, not just Talmud. And Bavel, it seems that they studied Talmud. So here, despite the fact that Bnei Ashkenaz often find their roots in Eretz Yisrael, Tosfos says that we follow, of course, Bnei Bavel and their Talmud. The interesting thing, which I won't elaborate on, but if you're interested in seeing the raging scholarly controversy, not always so pleasant, so there was a book that was published by a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, truly a wonderful person. She published a book about the Baalei Tosfos making certain claims about their relationship to the Bavli. The book was, to put it nicely, attacked by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik in a review of it. What's that?
I'll be putting it very nicely.
I understand that. I am putting it very nicely. It happens to be Dr. Soloveitchik is almost certainly correct on the substance of the matter, even though some of us may not like the style of the tone. It would not be the first review, but as is usually the case, he's right on the substance, and I think it's true in this case as well. It's Klivet Rashi, and Tosfos states explicitly here, but they had long accepted the authority of the Talmud Bavli. It doesn't mean some of the Minhagim don't come from Eretz Yisrael, but in terms of the way they looked at the authority, the Yerushalmi is considered secondary to the Talmud Bavli. Okay. I'd like to take this opportunity to wish everybody a Ksiva